Well, hello and welcome. You've tuned into a conversation between artists. For the next hour, we'll be exploring the mind and the creativity of our guest. This is Art Talks, and I'm your host, Bruce Carter. Well, hello again and welcome. Mark Hirsch, a photographer, is our guest today, H-I-R-S-C-H. You can find him at Hirsch, markhirschphoto.com. Also, you know, his project is called thattree.net. He's an editorial and a corporate photographer living in Dubuque. He spent nearly 20 years as a photojournalist until embarking on a freelance career in 2006. Interesting jump. His clients include Getty Images, the New York Times, John Deere, and many, many regional companies and institutions. He's married to Danae, and he has two children, Cassandra and Tristan, and a shaggy dog called Magnum. Recently, he's been photographing one single tree in a field every day for a year of the year. This project he called That Tree Baroque. It's on iPhone. Took it with an iPhone. And it was turned into a hardcover book that will be released soon or is released.
Has been released.
Very interesting. And he was recommended by my friend Ken Urban and Mark Hirsch. Welcome to the show.
Wonderful, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
Oh, pleasure. When I first contacted you, and you were in Wisconsin someplace, and I thought that you were up in the hinterlands, up by the lakes or something. But it's like, no, you're right in Dubuque.
I'm a stone's throw from Dubuque.
Stone's throw, yeah. You're right on down the road. It's a beautiful area up there. Dubuque is cooking. It's like really a nice art community and everything up there. Are you part of the art community up there?
Well, you know, I try to be active in the arts community. I was an exhibitor in last year's Voices of the Warehouse mm-hmm. Gallery show. Mm-hmm. This year was the ninth year. It'll be coming up again next year, 10-year anniversary, a phenomenal contemporary art program exhibited in the uniquely redeveloped Warehouse District of Dubuque. And it was a great place to, first showcase my project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Before we talk about your project, let's talk about your life. How did you come up? What were you like? Were you a photographer as a boy?
I was a typical adventurous young man. I have an identical twin brother, and I have two other brothers and a sister. And, we were just ordinary, rambunctious, curious kids, hunting, fishing, hiking.
Where did you grow up?
Grew up in Boscobel on the Wisconsin River, a little tiny burg of 2,000 people in southwest Wisconsin. Lived there until early 1970s when my father got promoted and took a job as a store manager in Platteville, Wisconsin, and brought me closer to Dubuque. Grew up in Platteville then.
Were you an athlete, or did you play sports?
No, I wasn't. I probably would have been a good runner, but my energies were a little misguided and a little misdirected. I was out doing other things, probably less productive.
Talent. Well, when did you discover your talent then?
It was not in my formative years. I discovered my talents when I was in college.
You were just a kid. You were just like everybody else then.
I was an ordinary kid, and I'm still a pretty ordinary fellow. Just, it took me until my sophomore year of college to discover that I had any creative interests or talents in the direction that I pursued, in it being photography. And it's crazy how it even came about. I was an undeclared major. I had a philosophy professor as my guide because I was an undeclared major. And so I took, as an advisor, he had me taking philosophy courses and a little bit of everything. And so I'm nearly 2 years into my college years before I discovered an interest in photography. And it came about because my twin brother and I were going to take a backpacking trip. And a good friend of mine, Bob Nelson, he was my eighth grade science teacher. He lives on 80 acres of landlocked property, just a really interesting fellow. And Bob says to me, "Well, you can't take a backpacking trip without a camera." I said, "Well, I don't know anything about photography." And he says, well, you need to get a 35-millimeter single-lens reflex camera. And so with his guidance and a young man that was a year behind me in high school to help me pick out a camera, I bought a Nikon FE2, which had, you know, an automatic function as well as a manual function. And my twin brother and I took this backpacking trip to Olympic National Forest in upstate Washington, and I shot all slide film back then. And slide film is not very forgiving exposure-wise, not much latitude. Shot chromes during the whole trip, not really even understanding the difference between slides and negatives, and got back and had those slides developed. And I got them, and I didn't have a projector, but I remember opening up that box and holding it up to the light and seeing, you know, the recollection of my trip through these 35-millimeter slides, and I was immediately inspired and intrigued, and I thought, I wonder if there's a way a guy could pursue a career with this skill set.
How cool. What a great story. Did you project him? Did you get a...
You know, so then a good friend of mine, Al Flesh, his parents had a projector, so I borrowed their projector, and we projected the images, and, you know, it was a really cool, adventurous discovery. Mm-hmm. You know, a potential career path brought about by a dear friend, and, you know, the rest is history. I ended up being a photographer.
What images of landscapes, of people, of sitting around the campfire?
Well, actually, no. I mean, it was a backpacking trip. There weren't people sitting around the campfire. It was my twin brother and I, and that was it. We were in the middle of nowhere. Oh. I mean, we were back there for 6 days, 6 nights, 7 days on a backpacking trip. Ooh. In the Olympic National Forest. Ooh. And, you know, I mean, we were newbies to backpacking, so it was an interesting experience.
Interesting. Yeah, that's almost the same story as the guy who gets up and makes the class laugh and he's hooked on play, on being an actor, or somebody seeing their name in lights or in the newspaper. Uh-huh. or getting a nice pat on the back for a picture. It's the same kind of thing. So then you decided, I'm going to be a photographer.
Yep, so now I change advisors. I went from having a philosophy professor as an advisor to somebody in the communications program, and kind of shifted around with advisors, and I eventually ended up with an art professor who also taught in the communications department. His name was Paul Latowski, and just a phenomenally motivating, inspiring fellow. He had the art background, but he also had a great appreciation for photography. And so he taught in both tracks. He taught in the art program and he taught in the communications program. And early on, Paul, there are people that are mentors and role models that lead you down the right paths. And Paul was one of those. Between myself and another student, Mike Burnett, one of my good friends in college, he saw in both of us the potential to become, you know, successful photographers. And I took a photojournalism class under a gentleman named Dirk Vanderwerker. And so Dirk exposed me to photojournalism. Paul helped me remain inspired with the creative aspects of photography. But between the two of them, I ended up capitalizing on the mutual skills, and I became a photojournalist. But you need the creative side as well as the storytelling side, and those guys were phenomenal influences on my choice to become a professional photographer.
What's the difference between a photojournalist and a photographer?
Well, you know, a photographer isn't necessarily telling stories with their images. And as a photojournalist, Dirk stressed that, hey, okay, you need interesting, compelling compositions. You need creative and interesting-looking images, but you also have a message to communicate. It's not just about pretty pictures. It's about telling the story through visuals.
But that should almost be the same criteria for an art photograph, too.
Yeah, maybe so. I don't know. I mean, until I embarked on this project, if you had asked me, what do you do? And I would have said, oh, I'm just a photographer, which is kind of a funny description for oneself. You know, it's odd how those personal perceptions of what you do, but honestly, that's how I would have described myself. Not that I didn't think that I was an effective communicator or creative in my craft, but I didn't view it with the same level I do today. Today, I would say, you know what? I recognize that I'm an artist. And reason being, it took a project like this one where I'm shooting the same thing every day for a year using the most basic of camera equipment. I mean, you know, I have an arsenal of high-end camera gear, you know, $35,000, $40,000 worth of digital SLR bodies, every imaginable focal length of lens, But for this project, I restricted myself to doing it with an iPhone, which is as basic and bare bones as it gets. And it forced me to, I describe it as that tree taught me to see. You know, I would say I could see in the past, but I didn't really, really see.
Go on.
So this project, so suddenly, you know, it's unlike my journalism days. In my journalism days as a visual storyteller, I would go into a scene, you're trying to force the action, trying to anticipate what's going to happen next, and make meaningful images with the goal of communicating whatever the topic or subject matter may be. But with a project like that tree, you know, I would walk out into the valley of that tree, and nothing is really changing except for the slow progression of the seasons. Probably the most dramatic change I would see would be the quality of light at any given hour of the day. But the landscape doesn't change quickly overnight. All those little subtleties that I probably would have missed because I wouldn't have the patient, considered perspectives that I learned through this process and this project. And the harder I worked to make images, the more difficult it was. I learned to go into the valley of that tree and be patient, be relaxed, and really view things with a considered eye.
Almost being a hunter.
Yeah, almost. But it's not like you're waiting for a dramatic quarry to arrive. You're waiting for either it's an epiphany or a realization, or you recognize the subtleties of a situation or circumstance. The quality of light. I thought I was good at interpreting quality of light until I embarked on this project. And suddenly I realized that I didn't have quite the perception of the quality of light that I always thought I did.
Hmm.
And fortunately for me, this project was one that allowed me the luxury of returning over the course of the day. You know, unlike a news situation or a journalistic project where it happens at 2 o'clock, it's over at 3, you have 1 hour opportunity to tell the story. That tree, you know, other than other obligations, I had whatever time I could find to commit to it to return. So I might see something and I'd look at the situation and I might go, oh man, that's a really interesting composition, but the light's not right. Boy, if I came back at sunset, that could be a really meaningful image. So I would kind of create this mental checklist of image possibilities, and I would return, and oftentimes that was the key to making the picture of the day.
What do you mean, a meaningful image? A meaning that an image that has meaning to it?
Yeah, well, I guess, no, a meaningful image being an image that satisfied my goals, my personal goals and objectives. It was so much different from what I did. You know, for 20 years, my ultimate goal was to tell the story or illustrate the theme for the readers, but also my goal was to satisfy that editor back in the newsroom or create a compelling image that matched the words by the writer that was assigned to that story. My goal was so much different from the goals that I set for myself with this project. It was all personal. It was self-driven. It was personal goal-driven.
Interesting. You're almost the difference between an illustrator of children's books to a drawer of watercolor portraits, where you're working for somebody else with somebody else's audience idea in mind, causing an effect in the reader, in the editor. That's what they want. And now you're going to personal satisfaction, personal enjoyment, personal goals. Did the other work kind of dilute your personal goals a bit?
I don't, well, I guess so, because, I mean, there's always a little bit of me in every image I ever did, whether I was telling a story for any particular story. Each photographer has their own style. And I think that my readers back in my journalism days would have recognized my work through my style. I mean, I have people still tell me today, oh, I so miss seeing your images in the Telegraph Herald, and they would relate to being able to tell a Mark Hirsch photo from a Dave Kettering photo from a Patty Carr photo, because each photographer has their unique perspective, their unique approach, just their personal vision. With this project, the only person that I really had to satisfy was myself. But it's funny because that even changed a little bit, because the longer I got into my project, the more public interest started to surface. In June of the project, I started the project on March 24th of 2012. In June of that year, a corporate client of mine, Southwest Health Center in Plattville, Wisconsin, their marketing director had shared my story with the local newspaper. So I got a phone call from the editor of the local newspaper in Plattville, Wisconsin, and he says, "Mark, Jamie Collins shared with me your story about that tree. I'd like to do a story about it in the newspaper."
Ooh.
So I'm like, I'm intrigued. I mean, that's interesting. Somebody outside of my personal goals is interested in my project. And what I'd been doing is I'd shoot my picture and I would upload it to my Facebook page, my personal Facebook page. And right away I'm like, oh, geez, I don't want to friend everybody that wants to follow my project. If this news article inspires some public interest, I need a way to share this without having to compromise my personal Facebook page. So I called my twin brother. I'm like, "John, this is going to happen. What do I do?" He says, "Well, you need to create a business Facebook page for that tree." So John and I sat down and wrestled through the process. He was on the phone. I was on the phone, had the website up there, and we built a Facebook page for that tree.
Thattree.net?
Well, actually, it's Facebook/photosofthattree.com. Thattree.net came about later. So the Facebook page. So I created the Facebook page. Now, instead of posting my daily photo on my personal page, I started posting them to the Facebook page for that tree. And I uploaded all of the photos that had been uploaded prior to that point to the Facebook page. So I had them all out there. So June 7th, the hometown newspaper interviews me. He runs a section in front of the newspaper, and he must have run, 4x6. So he ran 24 photos on the front of the newspaper.
Golly.
Just really nice panels. They're square panels because that's the format I've chosen. And ran the story, ran the link to the Facebook page, and pretty much overnight there were almost 400 people started following the project.
Nice.
Yeah, it was really kind of an interesting process, and it kind of showcased the power of social media and allowed me to share these images without compromising my personal page, because it's just one of those things. I'd rather not have business and my personal life tied together on one site. And that was my first embrace of social media. Now, the other avenue of social media that I'd used, this project goes back to January of 2012. In January of 2012, I got an iPhone. A friend of mine, who's a commercial photographer, a documentary photographer in Minneapolis, she sends me a note. She saw my post on my personal Facebook page that I got an iPhone, and her note to me was, sent me a text, "Isn't the camera great?" And I sent her back a text.
The camera in the iPhone?
And the camera in the iPhone. I said, "Seriously?" And her note was, "Yeah, no, really. Treat it like a camera." Like, okay. And so January 20th, 2012, I'm driving home from Plattville, Wisconsin, and I turn on the township road I live on. It's snowing to beat the band, and I look down, and here's this beautiful oak tree. I've driven by it for 20 years. I've never so much as stopped to make a picture of it. I parked my truck, ran down there through the snowstorm, pulled up my iPhone, just used the standard camera app on the iPhone, made half a dozen pictures of the tree, ran back to my truck. I'm not dressed for the occasion. I'm wearing dress shoes. I'm not wearing a winter jacket. Drove home. I'm like, how did I get these pictures off my iPhone on my computer? I mean, that was a total onophile. I hadn't treated it like a camera at all.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you click on the photo, it asks you, do you want to email it or do you want to save it? So I emailed it to myself. So I sat down on my laptop, launched Photoshop, opened up my email account, opened up the first picture I had sent to myself, and it pops up in Photoshop, and I'm looking at this incredibly nicely exposed, broad contrast, high key photo of the tree in the snowstorm, and I just started laughing at myself, because in the mid-90s, when I was at the Telegraph Herald, we had made the first investment in high-end digital cameras. They were a combination camera built by Canon, Kodak, and the Associated Press, and it was called the NC2000. The thing probably weighed 5 pounds. It was huge. It was as big as an old-fashioned telephone, and it was a 2-megapixel camera.
Ooh.
here's this incredible picture that I made with an iPhone that I pulled out of my pocket, and the iPhone is an 8-megapixel camera. An incredible realization of where the technology has come. And as a professional photographer, I had stopped making pictures for myself a long time ago. It was my career. You know, when I was in college and I got excited about photography, it was still a hobby. It was experimental. I was learning all the new tricks, learning to understand the difference between an f-stop and a shutter speed. But I quit making pictures for me. I made pictures for clients. I made pictures for illustration of stories, but I stopped enjoying photography. It became my career. Well, this crazy fresh exposure to this new technology and the simplification of the camera that's always in my pocket. So I started making a picture a day. And again, this friend of mine in the Twin Cities that inspired me to treat it like a camera, she's one of these photographers that delves into these in-depth projects that don't necessarily have any monetary reward, but they're incredibly rewarding personally and incredibly challenging because you're trying to illustrate a story that has meaning, but then the challenge is to compel other people to find it interesting and worth giving it the attention. I'm taking pictures now with my iPhone with no goal other than rediscovering my love for photography.
Fabulous. How very interesting. You've come full circle again then.
Yes, I have.
Mark Hirsch is with us. He used to be a corporate, well, he still is, an editorial corporate photographer, but now he's an iPhone photographer. Very, very clever. Let's pause right now, and we'll be right back after this gallery guide. And we're back on Art Talks. Mark Hirsch is with us. He's known as That Tree Guy. You can go to thattree.net.
Yes.
http://thattree.net. Marvelous pictures right on through the year. What an interesting idea to take a photograph of a tree out in a cornfield, kind of... What's the deal with a single tree and how did it survive on the prairie? And,
yeah.
And did some pioneer plant it or?
Questions I asked myself once, and you ask how the project came about. And, you know, I told you about the first picture I took on January 20th. And between that experience and my friend inspiring me to make pictures with my iPhone, I suddenly, it was a rediscovery of the simplicity of the camera in my pocket, and I suddenly found an interest to start making pictures for me again. So I start making a picture a day of whatever it might be, and I would post it on my Facebook page. And this is all thanks to my friend Corey. So I'm making whatever I might encounter. I'd see an interesting scene or quality of light or whatever it might be. I'm posting a photo a day on my personal Facebook page and kind of rediscovering my personal satisfaction, rediscovering my love of photography. And on March 13th, I'm driving home the same road that I took on January 20th, and incredible sunset. Hadn't posted a photo that day for my photo a day of whatever inspired me, and I turn onto that township road that I live on, and I look down, and I'm like, hey, that tree's in the right spot. So I parked my truck, ran down there in much nicer weather, got myself between that sunset and that tree, and I made a really nice photo of it at sunset, went home, and I posted it on the Facebook page. Continue to do this for the next 10 days. And on March 23rd, a friend of mine, an old mountain biking buddy, Greg Gunther, sees it on my page. And he sends me a note on Facebook. His note was, dude, what's with you and that tree? You should do a photo a day with it.
Ooh, that's
it. Yeah, it's a funny challenge. Uh-huh. And who knows why I felt compelled or inspired to follow his challenge. But literally, March 24th, the next day, and he's 10 days after I posted the photo, he finally discovered it. But he sends me that note. March 24th, I go out there and I decide today's the day, and I start my project officially to make a photo a day of that tree. And based on Greg's funny verbal, you know, description, it became that tree.
Huh. You were pushed into doing it.
Yes, yeah. Challenged, pushed, goaded.
What about all of your $30,000 worth of photography?
Well, I mean, I continue to use that, and I continue to use it today for my corporate, commercial, and editorial work. But when I'm shooting for me, it's the camera I have with me, and it's the iPhone in my pocket.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. Huh. But it's been a real exciting and interesting rediscovery of my love of the medium, and it's really helped me validate what I've said to people for 25 years. It's not the camera. It's the eyes behind it.
That's nice. That's true. It's the artist behind the machine.
Yep. And people will be like, what camera do you use? You know, and to try and get people to understand that a $5,000 camera is going to make you a better photographer.
Right.
You still have the same eyes, the same visual skill set behind it. So you may as well shoot pictures with your iPhone, or you may as well shoot pictures with your point-shoot camera. Don't invest your money in technology thinking it's going to give you creative skills. Train yourself, teach yourself, read, study, seek out a mentor, but don't think that buying expensive equipment is going to give you a skill set.
And finding your own style, too. You mentioned earlier that people recognize your style in the editorial photographs that you made for the paper. How would you describe your style? How did you find it? How does an artist find their style?
You know, I mean, for me, I tended to shoot with a more intimate perspective, mostly because when I first got into the newspaper industry, I didn't have fancy camera equipment. I had a very basic camera body and a 50-millimeter lens. Frankly, it harkens back to what I'm doing now with my iPhone, harkens back to when I was training myself as a photographer with a basic camera body and a basic normal lens. You know, I was the human zoom. And with an iPhone, once again, I'm the human zoom. I mean, I can't reach into my pocket and pull out a telephoto lens. I can't reach in my pocket and pull out a wide angle lens. The lens that's built into your iPhone is the lens that you have. They do make some accessory lenses. They're just not that sharp, and they don't give you enough of a change in focal length to make it, you know, the difference. So in my newspaper days, learning my style, learning my skill set, learning my approach, it was way more intimate because it was all done with a shorter focal length lens.
And now your iPhone will give you that?
Well, yeah, now with the iPhone, it's actually closer to a wide-angle lens. And that's been an incredible process in itself. I never would have described myself as a landscape photographer. I never really made any effort to shoot nature pictures or environmental landscape-type compositions. Most everything I did during my whole career was involved in telling stories, or it was involved illustrating sporting events, whatever it may be. Very, very seldom did I shoot a subject for the newspaper industry that involved a static subject like a tree in a cornfield. So this project, probably more so than any other medium I've ever pursued as a photographer, has had me, you know, it's inspired me to take a renewed appreciation for the skill set that I have, and I never really realized it. You know, I mentioned earlier, if you asked me what I did, I would have said, oh, I'm just a photographer, which is just a foolish description of oneself. But it took a project like this one, you know, tremendous feedback from people who found great appreciation in what I've done, family members reminding me of how lucky I am to have the skill set that I do. And suddenly I could step back and look at what I've done through this project, and it was a self-discovery. I learned a greater appreciation for how fortunate I am, because for me to go out there and isolate a vignette, isolate a composition, isolate a detail, or capture a landscape that reflects my visual perception of place, I thought everybody could do that. You know, it took a project like this one for me to realize just how fortunate I am to see the world the way I do. You know,
nice.
It made me realize that, hey, gosh, you know, it's like an alcoholic realizing they're an alcoholic. I suddenly realized, huh, gosh, I'm an artist.
But you know what? To top it all off, is just a tree in a cornfield.
Yeah, well,
and everybody's making...
You know what? I might have described it as just a tree in a cornfield at some point in time when I started this project, but it is so much more, so much more. I mean, without that tree there, without that host of life, it would be a monoculture of soybeans or a monoculture of corn, or unusually this year, on one side is soybeans and on the other side is corn, but it would have been totally a non-native habitat. The waterway that flows by that tree is all non-native, domestically planted European grasses. The only remnant of natural habitat that exists in that valley today is that wonderful 163-year-old bur oak tree.
Hmm. Is there a spirit to the tree? Is there a personification? Is this a person? Is this your ancestors? Is this the past?
You know, I describe that tree. I talk of that tree in the female sense. I talk about her inspiration or her role in the valley, and mostly because to me that tree went from being just a tree to, for me, pretty much the tree of life. It's like the mother of that realm. The incredible encounters I've had, be it with the deer or the turkey or the katydid backlit on its bark or the moth hidden on the bark, just an incredible realization of the role that tree plays as the, you know, the catalyst for the quality of life in that valley.
Interesting. The tree of life, and it's in the middle of a cornfield. It's round at the top. It hangs down.
Oh, it's got a beautiful
like hair.
Form.
It beautiful does have form. A beautiful form. You don't have to trim it. It's not ungainly or off to one side. It has a nice profile.
Yep, it does. And literally, the farmer that plants the fields next to it, he plants within 10 feet of the base of that tree.
Wow.
Now, fortunately, with today's implements, the bean head or the corn head or even the planter can reach far enough under the branch of the tree without compromising it. But that tree, historically, that is there, to me, is truly a miracle. In April of 2012, when I started my project, the farmer that owns it is a dear friend of mine from my high school days, and he and I were at a birthday party for my sister-in-law. And I had gone out to the tree that night to make my photo of the day. And I got to the party, and I was showing him the picture. At this point, you know, I'm a month into my project. And I showed it to him, and I said to him, Tim, I said, it just amazes me. Just amazes me that that tree exists where it does, perched so precariously, such a fragile existence on the edge of a cornfield. And Tim's, and you know, I said, you look at commodity prices, you know. Commodity prices are such that farmers are reducing their waterways. They're taking out fence rows. Where I'm at in northeast Iowa, southwest Wisconsin, there aren't that many livestock farmers anymore. It's predominantly grain farmers. And so if you can eke out an extra tenth of an acre by bulldozing off your fence rows, you're going to bulldoze off the fence rows. And I said to Tim, it just amazes me that that tree is still there, that it hasn't been knocked over. And Tim says, well, he says, I have a story for you. He said, in the spring of this year, before I started the project, he said, I had a bulldozer operator out there. He was taking out some fence rows for me. I was having him do some repair of some waterways that had some erosion in them. And he went out on a Saturday to inspect the work. And the bulldozer operator says to Tim, while I'm at it, you want me to push that tree over too? Oh my gosh. Tim told me that it just made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. And Tim's comment to the bulldozer operator was, that tree's been there for over 200 years. I'm not the guy that's going to knock it over. Oh,
nice
man.
Story.
Just amazing. And historically.
That close.
Yeah, that close. And you think about it. I mean, there are many trees, many lovely trees on the fringe of viable agricultural properties today that are living a very precarious existence. And, you know, historically, back in the days of horse-drawn implements, trees had a valuable role to the farmer. It was the place where when they took a break, they rested the horses in the shade of that tree. They sat down next to that tree and had their lunch. Their family might come out and meet them at lunchtime, or it was shelter, whatever it might be. But in our current era of agriculture, trees in the middle or in the midst of a cornfield or a soybean field don't have much value other than an impediment to agricultural practices.
Gosh, so that tree goes back to the 1800s.
Absolutely.
Early 1800s.
Yep. Yep.
Gosh, that's crazy.
Yeah, and historically, so, I mean, I've learned so much about place and that parcel of ground as a result of this project. I did some research because a gentleman, Raleigh Hankus, with a magazine, a regional magazine called Woodlands and Prairies, was going to do a story on my project. And so Raleigh starts asking me all these questions, you know, who owned it? You know, who owned it then? And how long has it been there? And I'm like, I don't know. And he was adamant. He really thought that the readers would find that really interesting. So I went to the Register of Deeds, and that was a frustrating process, trying to track back the ownership of that land. And eventually I connected with a title company in Lancaster, Wisconsin, that had a more organized method of tracking back property based on the parcel. And I was able to research that parcel of ground. And from it was first surveyed in the 1830s, by a surveyor named Lucius Lyons. And really interestingly, all of his field notes are available through the Wisconsin Historical Society online. Huh. So I was able to enter that quadrant of land and find the notes and discover the surveyor.
Ooh.
And so, you know, he talked about the land. He called it viable prairie, talked about a raised earth point and a bur oak branch used to triangulate a reference point for the land.
And that's bur oak tree.
And that's a bur oak tree. And then eventually the land was first bought by a guy named John Hawkins Roundtree. And in Illinois and Wisconsin, he was kind of a notorious fellow, kind of a land speculator, went on to become a politician. And so he owned it from 1832 until the late 1830s. And eventually the land changed hands several times. Then in 1869, it was bought by a man named John Vine. And members of the Vine family owned that land from 1869 until 1989.
Mm.
In 1989, the last descendant of the Vine family that owned the property sold it to a farmer. And when he turned sod that year, that was the first time it had been pasture up till that point. That was the first time in 1989, first time that soil had been turned. So probably the main reason that tree was still there.
Interesting. That's the original prairie? That was around it? Oh, that's great.
Yep.
That's great.
That's all gone now.
Well, I remember seeing the original prairie, and I felt transported to another time and place, the plant that faces north and south, that whole world.
Compass plant,
very good. Well, we're having a fascinating discussion about that tree out in the prairie, now a cornfield and a soybean field, with photographer Mark Hirsch. You can see his work at http://twicethattree.net or markhirschphoto.com for his more commercial work. Let's take another break right now, and we'll be right back after this gallery guide. And we're back on Art Talks. Mark Hirsch is with us, a photographer and iPhone photographer. This program and many, many previous programs going back over a year are available on our website, wvik.org. Click on the Art Talks icon after clicking on schedule, and they will appear by date, name of the artist, and a brief description of what they do. And Mark will probably call you a photographer. A landscape photographer? No, you're more
well,
than that.
It's funny. Yeah. I would say I've become a landscape photographer.
What are you? Anyway, you're not just a photographer.
No.
You're an artist photographer.
Yeah, I would say that today.
Yeah, well, this is an interview show of artists, so you're in good company. Let's talk cameras just briefly. You have some skill in that. You have some systems. What would you recommend for a good camera and printer and lenses and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, for years, when I was in the newspaper industry, I was always a Nikon shooter. And I shot with high-end Nikon gear until the late 90s. And then the late 90s, you know, it's a dogfight between Nikon and Canon to deliver the best quality of equipment. You know, if you ask me what I should buy for a camera, I would say get a Nikon or a Canon. So I started out as a Nikon shooter, and then due to some changes in the technology and some improvements that Canon offered at the time, they had better autofocus, a little bit more durable equipment, I transitioned and I went to Canon gear, which I still shoot with Canon gear today. But in the mid-2000s to late 2000s, Nikon kind of surpassed Canon in their autofocus technology and the durability of their equipment. Right now, I would say that they're probably pretty much an even-matched option, but my recommendation would be those two primary brands of equipment. Then as far as lenses, people always, you know, they want to buy an off-brand lens because you can get so many more options for your money. But realistically, I tell people, save your money. Wait until you can buy a fast Nikon or a fast Canon lens. And by a fast lens, I mean a lens that's got a large aperture, no smaller than f2.8. Reason being that in order to have a 2.8 piece of glass, the lens quality has to be superior. The ability to reproduce color realistically has to be better. Fewer chromatic aberrations in the lenses. Therefore, save your money Buy a fast Nikon or a Canon lens and you won't regret it.
How about printer?
Printer. Well, for my project, and even when I was in the newspaper industry, when I was at the Telegraph Herald in Dubuque, for our high-end printing for clients that would purchase prints, they used the Epson 4800 printer. Personally, for me, I couldn't afford a printer that prints quite that large, but I have an Epson 3880, and it is a phenomenal printer. Prints up to a 16 by 20, and they're just beautiful. I mean, they're museum-quality, archival-quality prints.
Is it very expensive for the cartridges?
The cartridges are very expensive, but it's phenomenal how many prints you can put through them.
Nice.
Now if you're just printing for yourself, if you're not going to put through enough volume to justify it, amazingly, some of the big box stores like Sam's and Costco, some of those places, if you go in with an SD card with your high-end print that you've processed in Photoshop or whatever, they will crank out prints for you for an extremely affordable price. I think you can get a 16 by 20 for like $6.
No kidding.
Incredible. And they're using the same printers that you would get if you went through a high-end online printing service, but you can go down to, if you're in a big enough metropolitan area, you can go down to your local box store, and odds are they can make you a very nice print for a very modest fee.
Wow, interesting. Interesting in a pinch. Rather than getting your own printer.
Yeah.
Gosh. So any other equipment that you're wearing, do you Photoshop it?
This project, no. Ironically, this project is, if people follow my project on Facebook, if they've seen the images on my thattree.net page, those images are all straight from the iPhone. Using my iPhone, my whole goal with this project was to treat it like a camera. A lot of people that are using their iPhone for capturing photographs are using Hipstamatic and Instagram and using those applications. They're using filters that pretty much change and modify the appearance of the images. I use an application called Camera Plus as my capturing application because it allows me to use two different controls on it. It allows me to choose the area that I want in focus, and it allows me to choose the area that I want the exposure based on. And it's truly treating my iPhone as if it were an SLR camera. Now, the one discovery that I made, of course, is that the best quality of light is the golden hour before sunset or just after sunrise.
Leonardo da Vinci's favorite time.
Yep, and in order to capture images utilizing my iPhone during those low light periods, I suddenly started using a tripod. And as a photojournalist, I didn't use a tripod. As a photojournalist, I would run into a news scene, I would use a very fast ISO, trying to get as fast a shutter speed as I could, and it was kind of run-and-gun photography. Now, it was meaningful imagery, but it was totally different than what I'm doing today. What I'm doing today, treating my iPhone like a camera, I would say it has made me a more considered photographer. I go in, I mount my iPhone in a tripod. I use a Manfrotto tripod legs with a Manfrotto magic arm. I clamp my iPhone in there, and I conceive my composition. And I call it a more considered approach to photography because it's a slower approach. Literally, I compose the image and I second guess myself and make the images from a tripod because I'm shooting, in very low light, which means I'm eking out up to a 1 second exposure from my iPhone. 1 second is the longest shutter speed that the iPhone will give you.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Yeah. And funny, but people are out there treating their iPhones or their Samsung devices like cameras, and they're going into these horrible lighting situations. And unfortunately, people are happy with autofocus pictures. As a photographer and a photojournalist, I'm not happy with autofocus pictures. And fortunately, I'm shooting a static object that isn't moving. So the biggest concern is sharpness of images because of my movements. So that's why I'm using a tripod.
How big is the depth of field on your iPhone?
It kind of depends. I'm shooting landscape images for the most part. So when you're shooting a landscape image, it's a fixed aperture in an iPhone. I think it's f2.4. So it's a pretty large aperture, which, if you're shooting a close-up of something, you're going to have very shallow depth of field. But because I'm shooting landscape-type compositions, it has the feel of a greater depth of field. Now, I shoot pictures that are details and close-ups using the iPhone, and people look at the pictures, and because it has a bokeh effect, which is limited area of focus, people look at it and they go, "You can't do that with an iPhone." And I tell them, "Yes, you can." but you can't necessarily do it using the built-in iPhone camera application, because the built-in iPhone camera application is more like a point-and-shoot. Using Camera Plus, I'm able to choose the area I want in focus, and I lock the focus. I choose the area I want my exposure based on, and I lock the exposure. The end result is pictures that look as if they were shot with an SLR.
You can do those two procedures in the camera?
Yes, in the camera. Yes, you're locking the focus and you're locking the exposure in the iPhone.
So you're
just
actually,
like I would with an SLR.
Like you're doing a manual.
Yep.
Oh, that's great. That's good, because otherwise you're relying on automatic exposure and automatic focus and all of that stuff, and it takes it out of your hand.
Yeah, it takes the creative control out of your hand, and it's a wish and a prayer, because the iPhone doesn't know what you're trying to shoot, just like any other single-lens reflex camera. You put an SLR in auto mode, it doesn't know whether you want the athlete in focus. It doesn't know whether you want the tree in focus. It has no idea.
Did you ever drive a stick shift?
Yes, I did.
Do you prefer stick shifts?
Absolutely.
Me too.
It's more sporty.
That's it. Well, sporty and more
and
control.
More active.
There you go. Golly. Gosh, we're rushing down toward the end. Mark Hirsch is with us. He's a photographer, and he's making a wonderful book called, That Tree. It's out now. That Tree, an iPhone photo journal documenting a year in the life of a lonely bur oak. Marvelous stuff. It's published. Who publishes this?
Press Syndication Group.
Was that a difficult thing, getting things?
It was a process. And actually, my publisher has been my photography representative forever. When I left the newspaper industry, he was a photo editor with World Picture News in New York, and he immediately put me to work covering news events throughout the Midwest. And he represented a tour photographer for Justin Bieber several years ago, and helped him, with the support of another gentleman, publish one of the Justin Bieber books. So that was his first exposure to publishing. So when I embarked on this project, he's always been my photography agent. About a month into the project, his name is Warren Winter, and Warren sends me a note on Facebook, the third friend who influenced this project. And his note to me is, gosh, Mark, I'm digging this tree project. He said, I think if you win a year, we could publish a book. And so I embraced it immediately. And about a month later, he sends me a note. Hey, he goes, you're going to do this. He goes, my challenge was tongue-in-cheek. He wasn't that serious. But, you know, as my agent and the guy who's directed me and guided me successfully all along, I thought he was dead serious. And so he's extremely happy that I went the distance.
Oh, nice. Was it a long distance?
It was. I mean, you think about it. Shooting a photo a day of something for a year, forced my family to make some sacrifices. Didn't do a family vacation that year. My annual ski trip with my buddies. It was a foregone conclusion.
You
I couldn't
do it.
Have to
milk the cows.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of describe it that way. You know, I suddenly had an empathy for the farmer being hostage to his dairy herd.
Right.
But it was an incredible experience. I mean, I'm telling you. You know, as it wound down, to look back and consider the things I learned, the skill sets I gained, I became a much more considered photographer. I became a more contemplative photographer. It forced me to slow down, take a more appreciative view of something so common and ordinary as a tree in a cornfield. I mean, if in my photojournalism days, if I'd have gone to one of the staff photographers that answered to me in the newspaper industry and said, I want you to make a picture a day of a tree, they'd have thought I lost my mind. If one of those photographers had come to me and said, hey, I want to make a picture a day of a tree, I'd have thought they lost their mind. But having completed the process and had the experience, wow, unbelievable the rewards.
Interesting. Is there something in your mind thinking about the next project, or is this kind of a once-a-lifetime?
Yeah, you're not the first person to ask me that, Bruce, but this project came about so organically and so naturally.
Yeah.
I'm hoping my next one comes about half as conveniently.
It's almost like a novelist. You're writing a book, and your whole life has come into this project, and what you learned, it's so interesting. You become a more contemplative, more natural, a more vibrant photographer. This tree has made you a better man.
It has, most definitely.
And a better artist, too.
Yes, absolutely. That's probably the greatest realization for me.
And perhaps a realization that you are an artist.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, I talked about that before, that I would not have described myself as an artist ever in the past, but now I'm so fortunate that I am.
Right. Mark Hirsch has been with us for this last hour, a photographer, a wonderful opportunity, a wonderful project. Mark, it's time for our last question. What advice do you have for young photographers, for young artists coming up?
Well, probably the best advice is the lesson I learned from the tree this last year. You know, you can't force opportunity. You know, we all question the path we're taking in our life. This project, after 2 weeks, I'd shot all of the predictable images, and I'm like, what have I gotten myself into? And I remember I took a walk around the valley, and I decided, you know, the only parameters to restrict my visual goals are the parameters I set for myself. So I approached the project from then on with a more open mind, a more open heart, and I realized that, you know, anything is possible, and it's there in you. We all second guess our skill set, but you've got to trust in your ability and have confidence and faith, and things will work out.
Excellent. Well said. Mark Hirsch has been with us, a photographer, thattree.net and markhirschphoto.com. That's it for us today on Art Talks. Many thanks to our guests. Many thanks to our audio engineer, that maestro of sound, Dave Garner. As always, I'm Bruce Carter. Until next week, have a great night and a fine tomorrow. See you soon, Mauro. Thank you.